What makes a happy life? How do we find joy and the joy and fulfillment we're searching for? Isn't that the million-dollar question? Isn't that deep down the question that all of us have asked and even been searching for? What actually provides joy and fulfillment and meaning and happiness? People have been asking that question. Of course, the question's as old as the hills. The answer is older than the hills, as you know. But what makes a happy life? If you would turn into Ecclesiastes chapter 1, there was a recent survey of young people, and they were asked what their most important life goals were. Over 80% said a major life goal was to get rich. Now that's not just this generation. This goes back many generations. 80% said a major life goal was to get rich. 50% said another life goal was to become famous. Is that where happiness is found? What makes the happy life? Well, that was the question of a 75-year Harvard study. 75 years. They have been conducting this study. It started off with some freshmen, 18, 19-year-olds. It expanded. They followed their lives through the course of their lives. Some are now in their 90s. Many have passed away. They've broadened the control group to their wives, because they started off with all men, because back then Harvard was just a male-only university. So now the study includes their wives. Then the study included impoverished children from Boston. They wanted to expand the group, and the study's been going for 75 years. And my question is, aren't you guys the Harvard PhDs? I mean, aren't you guys the ones who are supposed to be smart and happy? Aren't you supposed to be telling us what the happy life is? No, they're asking us. And so that kind of gives you an idea. The study's been going for so long, 75 years, that it's had four different directors. And each of the directors took a stab at trying to figure out what brings happiness. And, you know, they're dealing with a mountain of data, especially now, because they did interviews, they did brain scans, they did blood tests. And then as it progressed, you know, they start asking their wives. Then they start asking their children. And now the study includes the children of those who are in the original study. But the four different directors each tried to take a stab at what all the data meant, because that's essentially what they're doing. They're looking at the data, and then they're looking through their own expertise, their lens, and trying to decipher the code of what makes people happy. Early on, they thought it was genetics. Now, remember, whoever the director was had his own medical background. So he's viewing the data through his own lens. And back then, genetics was the big deal. Had to be genetics, right? Well, they determined that wasn't it. Then they thought, well, physical health and intelligence. That's what makes a happy life. If you're physically healthy and you're intelligent, that makes a happy life. That ended up really not being it. Later, they thought personality. Personality, right? That's what does it. Personality and success. That makes a happy life. That was what one of the other directors thought. They are still collecting data. They're still doing the study. I can tell you this. We'll circle back to the study, but I'll tell you one thing that they did determine. Happiness is not found by accident. They can determine that. Happiness is not found by accident by winning the lottery of life. That's kind of how we looked at it. If you won the lottery genetically, or if you won the lottery economically, you know, or if you won the lottery of health and personality, but it doesn't work that way. And they can tell that from the study. that happiness is not a result of accident, of winning life's lottery. And so the study continues, the search for the happy life continues. And I just want to point out that this is the same search that Solomon was on. When we see Ecclesiastes 1 and verse 12, I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. I set my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven, this burdensome task God has given to the sons of man, by which they may be exercised. So, depending on who you talk to or who you read, you're going to get different answers. Freud thought pleasure, that was the answer. Nietzsche thought power. Power is the answer. You know, Viktor Frankl said no. Viktor Frankl was a psychologist who was in the concentration camps because he was Jewish. And he saw power taken away, and he saw pleasure taken away, but still people had a will to live. And he thought, no, it's not power, it's not pleasure, it's something more. It must be something that has to do with meaning. People are searching for meaning. Well, Solomon is on a search. And let's remember something about Solomon. He's king of Israel. He possesses more of this world's power and pleasure and possessions than any other person in history. In other words, Solomon had it all. He'd already won the lottery of life. And yet he's still empty. He's still searching. Even though he's already won the lottery of life. Okay? Let that sink in. This is why Solomon really was the perfect person God chose for this search. He'd already won the lottery of life, and yet he's still searching. And so let's take a look at this search. He's trying to find meaning, true meaning and happiness in different things. And he's going to start with human knowledge. And that seems like a good place to start, right? Don't you usually want to grow in your understanding and knowledge to figure things out? So in chapter 1, look at verse 16. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, beginning in verse 16. I communed with my heart, saying, look, I've attained greatness and I've gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. And I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is grasping for the wind. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. So Solomon is pursuing knowledge and wisdom as a pathway to happiness. And the more, and let's remember, when you go back to like 1 Kings 11, we're talking about someone who studied botany. He studied nature. He studied zoology. He studied medicine. He probably studied mathematics and astronomy. He studied everything under the sun, as well as wisdom and scripture and truth, right? And wisdom, of course, is discernment or the proper application of knowledge. Knowledge is inert, doesn't do anything. Wisdom, it takes wisdom to apply it. And he gained so much intellectual understanding that kings and queens and rulers and judges and scholars would travel long distances to hear the wisdom and knowledge of Solomon. Remember the Queen of Sheba? She traveled all that way and she said, when I actually heard and sat down with Solomon, it was greater than what I'd even heard from afar. And what did Solomon find out? He said that more wisdom only leads to more grief. More knowledge only leads to more sorrow. Why is that? I just want you to stop and just take a minute to think about this. There are many very knowledgeable people in the world, and they're not happy. They know more than anybody else in the room at all times, but they're not happy. There are very intelligent people who are not happy. And so knowledge and intelligence does not bring happiness. In fact, it often brings sorrow. The more I know about my government, the sadder I get. Right? More knowledge doesn't help. The more I know about higher education, the more sorrow I have. The more I know about the smartest people with the highest IQ, the more discouraged I become. Why? Because if you look at their lives, you realize even they don't have the answer. As smart as they are, They don't have the answer. They're not happy. And so the answers of life are not within man. They're only from God. So he tried human knowledge. That wasn't it. So then he says, let's try pleasure. Look in chapter 2 and verse 1. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with myrrh. Therefore enjoy pleasure, but surely this also is vanity. I said of laughter, madness, and of myrrh, what does it accomplish? You would think that the pursuit of pleasure would bring happiness. And entertainment is not wrong, but it quickly fades away. It's like cotton candy, you know, it's great and then it's gone. It only lasts, think about entertainment, it lasts for a few days or maybe a few hours or maybe even just a few minutes and then it's gone. Think about the perfect vacation. It eventually ends, you know, and then it's over and then you got to pay for it. And even if you were rich enough to be on permanent vacation, you're still going to face the storms of life. You might remember my two favorite billionaires. They're still fighting. They've been fighting for over 10 years. They live next door to one another on a Caribbean island. One is a fashion tycoon from Canada. The other is a hedge fund billionaire from the United States. And they happen to buy a property next to each other on some Caribbean island. I forget which one. And they hate each other. This guy likes to partay, so he's blasting music all the time, which drives this guy crazy. And so this guy began to sue this guy, and then this guy started to sue this guy. And they've been in a legal battle for over 10 years, to the point where one of them was accused of hiring a hitman. And my thought is, you're a billionaire. Go buy your own island. You're a billionaire. You're supposed to be happy, right? Oh, hello? But they're still locked in litigation. They still hate one another. And so, obviously, even being a billionaire, even pursuing pleasure, it still leaves people empty. Not even $1 billion is enough, right, to make people happy. So Solomon tried the pursuit of pleasure. It still left him empty. So how about alcohol? How about alcohol? Chapter 2 and verse 3. I searched my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine, while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. So, alcohol, maybe that's the way to happiness. And some people think alcohol will make them happy, and there's a $1 billion industry telling them that it will. Right? And if you look at the commercials, that's what alcohol is supposed to do, right? It's supposed to make you happy. It's supposed to make you important. It's supposed to make you popular. That's what the ads say. But alcohol is a depressant. It actually acts as an anti-anxiety. And so, it's actually a depressant. And so a lot of people self-medicate to deaden their conscience or numb the pain of the past without realizing the long-term effects. That Harvard Grant study I was telling you about, the 75-year study, they found one thing that was more destructive than any other to happiness. They found the number one most corrosive, destructive force to happiness, and it was alcohol. Alcoholism. Because at first, alcohol releases endorphins, and it does make people feel good at first. But behind the scenes, it is chemically addictive, and it's corrosive to health and happiness. A British study found that even moderate use shrinks the area of the brain used for cognition and learning. So alcohol is shrinking the area of the brain that is for cognition and learning. A 30-year Oxford study found through MRI scans of the brain that the amount of shrinkage in the hippocampus, which is the brain area associated with memory and reasoning, was related to the amount of people, the amount of alcohol people drank. So they actually, over 30 years, were able to measure the shrinkage of that area of the brain, the hippocampus, and it directly correlated to how many drinks that they had, the amount of alcohol that they took in. Because if you think about it, alcohol, it is toxic to your body. That's why it makes you feel the way you feel, because it's toxic. There were heavier drinkers had the most rapid decline of cognitive abilities. A Harvard study confirmed the same alcohol, that alcohol caused cognitive decline. And so you've got, you know, a British study, you've got an Oxford study, a Harvard study, all saying the same. The good news is, by the way, if you did drink a lot in the past, your brain can, when you stop, your brain can heal itself. It can grow back. But the Harvard Grant study found that alcohol was almost as destructive as loneliness and relationship conflict to happiness. And if you think about it, alcohol involves all three. Loneliness, because alcohol causes us to withdraw, relationship conflict, and alcohol actually promotes all three. So you got this toxic trifecta. So here's Solomon. He's trying to fill his emptiness with alcohol, but it just leaves him more empty. So it wasn't the answer. He's still searching. So then how about human achievements? That seems positive. In chapter 2, look in verse 4. I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. So he's still searching. He's still trying to find happiness. And when you read this section, 1 through 11, and you count the number of times Solomon uses the word I, my, or myself, over 30 times. I did this. I did that. This was about me. This is about myself. And when you ask yourself, how many times did any of this help others? How many times was he looking to try to help others with their happiness? None. None. All of these great plans and building projects, remodeling projects, gardens, parks. I get nervous when Lisa starts watching the Home and Garden, you know, those remodel shows, because I know after she's watching them, it's only a few days, or we need to redo this, or we need to redo. My sister said she finally just stopped watching those shows because it made her so unhappy with her kitchen, you know? It just made her unhappy with her house the more she watched those shows. But anyway, it does help. You know, when we have projects and we're working with our hands, all of those are positive things. But it's not the true fulfillment and happiness that we're looking for. The heart knows there's something more. How about materialism? He tried that. Look at verse 7. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the son of men, and musical instruments of all kind. He's just acquiring people and things. And he's got full-time staff now. You know, we're going to have servants and slaves, and we're going to have people working full-time around the clock to make me happy. He acquired full-time singers. Imagine if you were Solomon, you had the money to bring the greatest musical legends to come and give you your own private concerts. That's the kind of power and money that Solomon had. Full-time comedians. Just, you could have your own comedy show, you know. He's trying laughter. He's trying alcohol. He's trying projects and materialism. And as a collector, he amassed a lot of gold and silver. 1 Kings 10, each year Solomon received about 25 tons of gold. This did not include the additional revenue he received from merchants and traders, all the kings of Arabia and the governors of the land. So he's got 25 tons of gold coming in per year. And that's not including everything else. Then the king made a great throne covered with ivory and overlaid with pure gold. The throne had six steps, and the footstool of gold was attached to it. On both sides of the seat were armrests with a lion standing beside each of them. 12 lions stood on the six steps, one at either end of each step. Nothing like it had ever been made for any other kingdom. So this is the throne that Solomon sits on. All King Solomon's goblets were gold, and all the household articles in the palace of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. Nothing was made of silver, because silver was considered of little value in Solomon's day. There was so much gold that silver just wasn't even important anymore. The king had a fleet of trading ships manned by harem servants. Once every 3 years, it returned carrying gold, silver, and ivory, and apes and baboons. King Solomon was greater in riches and wisdom than all the other kings of the earth. It just wasn't enough. The eyes are never satisfied with seeing. The ears are never satisfied with hearing. He'd already won the lottery of life, and he's still searching. So how about human greatness? That's really when somebody reaches the uber rich, the money isn't enough. They want to become a legend. And that's where they start working towards. They want to be a legend for all time. And so he's going to try human greatness. Verse 9, "So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me." So King Solomon became the greatest geopolitical leader of his time, greater than all the kings of the earth. In fact, King Solomon was greater in riches and wisdom than all the other kings of the earth. All the kings of the earth sought audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom God had put in his heart. He's becoming a legend. Think of a powerful ruler who has an incredible IQ, who happens to have a photographic memory, and has all the wisdom that was given to him by God far more than anyone else. Yeah, he was a prodigy. And his reputation is spreading through the whole world. And it's just not enough. He's still searching. And so he's going to try selfish indulgence. Chapter 2 and verse 10. "Whatever my eyes I desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward from all my labor. Then I looked on the works that my hands had done, and on the labor in which I toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping for wind. There was no profit under the sun." He said that he withheld nothing that his eyes desired. And we know that he had wives and concubines, trophy wives, basically. And we read that he had 700 wives and princesses, 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. "For it was so when Solomon was old that his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David." He had done it all, and he was still empty, to the point where even 1,000 wives wasn't enough. It ended up just drawing his heart away from God. And basically, he comes to the conclusion that it was all just chasing the wind, you know? Even though he'd won the lottery of life, it was all temporary, and it didn't satisfy. I'm reminded of William Randolph Hearst. He became one of the richest men of his day. Hearst Newspapers, he began. He became so rich that he built himself a castle Because isn't that what you do when you get that rich? You build yourself a castle. And he imported everything from Europe. So he had all the greatest everything to build this castle. And then what do you do with the castle? You got to fill it with something. So he began collecting art. And he's collecting high value art from all over the world. He's got a full-time staff just to chase down valuable, famous pieces of art. And he's going through his books and he comes across a painting and he's like, I need this painting. So he calls the head of staff for his art department and he just tells him, I want this painting. I don't care what it costs. I don't care what you have to do to get it. I want this painting. And so he sent off his chief of staff who regularly would go around the world tracking down pieces of art for William Hearst, Randolph Hearst. Well, a few months go by and he's searching all over his contacts, no doubt, all over the world. And a few months later, he comes back and he says, you know that piece of art you were looking for? I finally tracked it down. It was in your basement. He'd already bought it. And it was down in the basement with a bunch of other art. And here he had sent this guy over tracking this piece of art down, and it was in the basement the whole time. Because Randolph had totally forgotten that he'd had it. It just doesn't last. And so let's draw some conclusions. And I want to point out that the two conclusions we're going to draw here can map out the entire book of Ecclesiastes. Number one, we must live with wisdom in harmony with God and His will. Otherwise, we're going to discover that all our works are vanity. This really is chapters 1 through 6 of Ecclesiastes. We have to live with wisdom in harmony with God and His will. Otherwise, everything we do, all of our works, it's all going to be meaningless. It's all going to be empty. And that's the conclusion that he draws. Steve Jobs was considered a tech visionary. And he had become one of the most richest and one of the most powerful men in the business world. At the peak of his career, Apple had more cash than any other company in world history. Apple had more cash than most foreign countries. That's how powerful he became. And even though at the end of his life he got cancer, and even though he's fighting cancer, he's actually fighting a corporate war against Google, because the CEO of Google at the time, Eric Schmidt, was on Apple's board while Apple was developing secretly the iPhone. And so the CEO of Google is in and hearing about all the secret development of the iPhone. Well, wouldn't you know that a lot of that ended up into the Android, Google's phone. And I don't know, I'd like to know the whole story. I don't know when Steve Jobs started picking up on this, but the time came when he realized that Android, he believed, was ripping off their development of the iPhone. And what happened was Jobs became livid, because Android, and Jobs could see it, was already going to overtake the iPhone. Android was going to surpass the iPhone in number of units and number of users. And this is what Steve Jobs said about it. He said, I will spend my last dying breath, if need to, and I will spend every penny of Apple's $40 billion in the bank to right this wrong. I'm going to destroy Android because it's a stolen product. I'm willing to go thermonuclear on this. Now, if you know anything about Steve Jobs, he would have, had he lived long enough, he would have spent every dime that he could have, and even spent down to his dying breath. And what did it gain him? He became legendary But in the end, he's spending his last dying breath fighting in legal battles against another tech company. It just, I don't think it was what he thought it was. Steve Jobs was an empire builder. He was a visionary. So was Solomon. Solomon was an empire builder. Solomon was a visionary. But Solomon realized at the end of his life that when we live and work without God, everything results in emptiness. It won't matter. And so he writes here in verse 12, "Then I turned myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who succeeds the king? Only what he's already done. Then I saw that wisdom exceeds folly. A man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I perceive the same event happens to them all. So I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, this also is vanity. For there is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever, since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. And how does a wise man die? As the fool. Therefore I hated life because of the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, for all is vanity and grasping for the wind." Imagine you came up with the most incredible invention of your life, an invention that changed the world, and then someone else stole the idea and then surpassed you with it. And that's how mad Steve Jobs was. And so Solomon gets to this point where I do all this in my life. I build all this. I did all this. And now I have to leave it to someone else who I'm just basically handing over to, and who knows if they're even wise or a fool. And I'm going to die and he's going to die no different from one another, even though I was wise and he was foolish. In the end, it doesn't matter. And so, verse 18, "Then I hated all my labor in which I toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will rule over all my labor in which I toiled and in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. Therefore I turned my heart and despaired of all the labor of which I had toiled under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, yet he must leave it his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. For what has man for all his labor and for the striving of his heart with which he's toiled under the sun? For his days are sorrowful and his work burdensome. Even in the night his heart takes no rest. This also is vanity." Listen to that last passage. Even in the night, his heart takes no rest. He could not rest. Even at the end of a successful, more successful life than maybe anyone, Steve Jobs would think, and yet he doesn't even rest at night at the end of his life. And he died of cancer. And Solomon says, this also is vanity. We have to live with wisdom in harmony with God and His will. Otherwise, we discover all our works as vanity. However, when we live with wisdom in harmony with God and His will, we can live it with peace and appreciation for God's blessings, regardless of outside circumstances. That's chapters 7 through 12. That if we live in harmony with God and His will, if we have that kind of wisdom to live in harmony with God and His will, we can have peace and appreciation. We can find meaning and happiness in God regardless of outside circumstances. It takes us to a whole nother place. And that's the second half of Ecclesiastes. Chapter 7 through 12. This is the wisdom that withstands the storms of life, regardless of outside circumstances that are always going to change. But if we live with wisdom in harmony with God and His will, we can actually appreciate and enjoy life. And this is what Solomon concludes. I'm going to read it here in the NIV. He says, a person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their toil. This too I see is from the hand of God. For without him, without God, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the person who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after wind. You see, Solomon is drawing this conclusion that you don't have to win the lottery of life. In fact, let's just be honest, you're not going to. You would have by now. But that's not where true happiness is found. True happiness is found in living in harmony with God and His will. True happiness is not based on winning the lottery of life. It is based on living in harmony with God and His will. This is the conclusion that Solomon reaches after a long, successful and not so successful life. We can appreciate and enjoy the gift of life because we love and trust God. Just amazing that Solomon won the lottery of life and he still couldn't find true happiness. He was looking in all the wrong places, under the sun without God. So, money, power, pleasure, success. When the Harvard Grant Study started looking at, you know, what they thought brought happiness, genetics. Well, genetics are good, but joy is better. Intelligence. Well, intelligence is good, but joy is better. Success. Success is good, but joy is better. You see? Money, materialism, achievements, indulgence, they can't survive the storms of life. They're not going to last. And so the Harvard Grant Study, interestingly, at least with the fourth director, believes that happiness is not from winning the lottery of life, it's found in loving relationships. That actually is what brings happiness on this earth. And I find that interesting because Solomon discovered the same thing, that true happiness in life is found in the most important relationship that you have, the relationship between you and God. That's what Solomon found. And if you think about it, life, love, enjoyment, happiness, fulfillment, these are all gifts from God. And they were not intended to be wasted on self-indulgence, right? They were intended to be appreciated and enjoyed as gifts and to give glory to God, to give Him the praise. So, true happiness is not based on winning the lottery of life. It's based on living with wisdom and harmony with God and His will. It's so interesting that, as I said, the Harvard Grant Study says that they found happiness is found in loving relationships. I find that fascinating because this relationship between us and God is the key to true happiness. And it's so critical that God was willing to send His Son to restore it. Paul says, God demonstrated His own love for us. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Since we have now been justified by His blood, how much more shall we be saved from God's wrath through Him? For if, while we were God's enemies, we were reconciled to Him through the death of His Son, how much more, having been reconciled, shall we be saved through His life? So this one relationship between you and God was so critical, so key to your eternal well-being, that God sent His Son to die for you, just to reconcile your relationship with Him. And that relationship is where we can find joy and peace and love and happiness. And it's all through fellowship with God. But it took the blood of Jesus to make it happen. But doesn't that show you how much God loves you? Doesn't that show you how important this relationship is to Him? That He would send Jesus and that Jesus would accept the difficult task of dying on a cross just so you could spend eternity with him in heaven. And so, yeah, you're not going to find what you're looking for on this earth without God. It's not there. It's not what you're actually truly looking for. But you can find it in your relationship with God through Jesus Christ. And what a beautiful truth. Something that Solomon probably didn't even fully yet realize, because Jesus had not yet died on the cross. That wouldn't come until 2,000 years later, or over 1,000 years later. But this was the eternal plan from before time began. This was the plan that God had in mind all along. If we can help in any way, please let it be known as we stand and sing.